Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
This show brought to you by Hyundai Tucson and Santa Fe. Hyundai questioned everything to create the best Tucson and Santa Fe's ever. Every inch of the all-new Tucson and Santa Fe's have been completely reimagined, resulting in the best SUVs ever. And you learn more at HyundaiUSA.com. All right, we talked to wildly successful author and humanitarian, really, Mitch Albom. And he wrote Tuesdays with Maury and many other books. You remember some hot crosstalk at the top. First, there's Geico. Do you own? Do you rent? Well, you do one or the other, right? You know, it's hard work out there. Owning, renting. You want to save some money? How about you bundle? Bundle your policies at Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle the homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you got so much to do already. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save at Geico. That is geico.com today. That's geico.com.
This is Walk-In's Welcome with Bridget Fettesy.
I love hearing people's stories of resilience and grit. This is why I created this podcast.
We are very excited to welcome Jim Gaffigan,
Yasmin Mohammed,
Glenn Beck,
Tim Dillon,
Abigail Schreier,
Jeff Garland,
Ayan Hirsi Ali,
Sam Harris,
Heather Hying,
Jonah Goldberg,
Ben Shapiro,
Glenn Greenwald,
Sarah Shahi,
Colin Quinn.
If there's a culture of victimhood, then let's tell stories of grit and survival.
Subscribe and listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, New York Times best-selling author Mitch Albom. With Gina Grad on news, Bald Brian on sound effects, and a holiday edition of Tales from the Cheap. And now, he spent the first three nights of Hanukkah trying to spell Hanukkah. Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. The church is going to mandate you get it on. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend. We love that about you. Right, Gina Grad?
That's right.
And Bald Brian?
Fuck those Mormons.
Oh, God.
Mitch Albom is going to be on about half an hour or so. I just had a long chat with him for my Take a Knee podcast. Very interesting dude. My goodness. Man, you thought you knew Mitch Albom, but sold 40 million books and Tuesdays with Maury obviously got him on the map. Very interesting story to that as well. I mean, we'll get into all that with him and how all that came about, plus his philanthropic stuff. Has an orphanage in Haiti. Man, it just keeps going.
He out-Oprah'd Oprah.
I know. Plays in a band with Stephen King.
Oh, my God.
And
Judy Blume and J.K. Rowling.
That's right. And like Dave Barry. Like, sure. They have a band of writers who... Anyway. So we'll get into all that with Mitch. I think my dad may have outdone my mom in the lackadaisical parenting department.
Impossible.
I know.
It seems tough.
And I'm going to throw it out to you guys. I feel a little too close.
Right.
But you tell me. Now, my mom's currently at the top of the leaderboard.
Top?
It's opposite day.
It is a race to the bottom. So she's at the bottom of the leaderboard because of the 99 comment when she presented the question to the table, which is filled with relatives and the like, celebrating, I think, somebody's birthday, hers or grandma's. But anyway, she starred famously, you guys know the story, where she'd gotten another flyer for cable. And she announced they keep wanting her to get cable.
They're haranguing her.
Yes, as I've, so I'm fond of saying, if it starts with the word basic and it's too rich for your blood, it's gut check time as an adult. Like it's called basic table,
yeah,
and you're wrestling financially, yeah, of whether you can squeeze the trigger at age, you know, 67 yeah, and a half with something that starts with the word basic.
Yeah. Maybe about $6 a month.
And then has like, and 99 cents.
Right.
Like when there's a cost to it.
That's
it gets
how they get you.
It gets into the pennies.
Yep.
You shouldn't be wrestling with it.
I think Alaska Airlines is offering basic economy, which is below economy. And if you're thinking like, I don't know if I can afford that, take the bus.
Do you hold a subway strap?
I guess. I wouldn't know, Gina.
Oh, yeah.
So they keep wanting me to get this cable. And then she, of course, presents, can anyone at the table give me one good reason to get cable? Of course, I had two shows on cable at the time. So that was an interesting. The phrasing of it was interesting. I don't know if my dad beat her on when I visited with
him.
We'll
be the judge.
It's a low bar.
Over the weekend. But my dad, you know, he doesn't really have his thumb on the pulse of what's going on in the world.
Really?
Or me or creativity or books or docs or anything like that.
Is that what's trending?
No. But it and will ironically say things like, oh, man, I got Dennis Prager's book. Have you ever talked to Dennis? Like, what's that like? And I go, yes, I made a movie with Dennis Prager. And he goes, oh, all right. And then we get back to talking
back to
about Dennis's books, which is weird that he likes now this one half. But anyway, he's never gotten around to No Safe Spaces. But I think my stepmom, who's sort of normal, kind of keeps him in the loop. She gets on the computer. She looks up stuff and maybe gives him a couple of talking points for, you know, when I come visit.
Good producer.
She produces. And so he said, now, what is this thing? You're doing something. They always, again, I'm always interested in this, which is the people that will not, and maybe it's not give you the satisfaction or they just won't, but they won't commit to actual titles.
Mm.
You know, my family's a lot of, is the puppet? What's your puppet?
The Yankees.
Is that still
the Yankers?
That'd be way too.
Oh, they can't even get
way
that
too involved. Yeah,
those crass puppets.
Are you doing the puppet on the comedy?
The Ha Network.
The comedy show network.
The
what is that? What is that? What number is the comedy network or whatever? I'm like, I don't know. Do you have a basic
check your
cable
local listings
or the dish?
Yeah.
I don't know what you have. By the way, you know, there's a show, it's called Friends, right? It's on, NBC, ABC,
yeah,
whatever. It's The Office. You know what I mean? The shows have titles.
Yeah.
And then,
easy to memorize.
And then they're on a network that has a name to it. Sometimes it's HBO and Cinemax or Showtime or ABC, but then you have that and then you have that. Those are really only two things you need to really commit to memory, but it's always, it's the thing with, which is always, I'm always curious, like, why are you advertising? You know what I mean? Like, pretend, you know. But so my dad said, what is you doing something with your car friend? And I said, my car friend. And he said, yeah, doing something with
Herbie?
The car person, car guy,
love bug?
Car something. And I said, well, first off, I know he doesn't know who Matt DeAndre is because I've only known him for 13 years to do a podcast with him. But I said, you talking about Matt DeAndre? We do car stuff? No, the car
if they're
friend.
Talking about Leno, I'll lose my mind.
He's talking about Jay Leno.
Oh, my God.
Now, first off, look, he's older. His memory's fading. But why downgrade Jay Leno into the car guy friend of yours?
You
why not
surely
just
know
say,
him from other things.
Your car friend. One of the 100 most famous people in America.
Yeah.
And the guy was number one in late night for 23 years.
When so you were lucid.
Give him the title he's earned. But so he gives the
car friend.
He's a car friend guy. I go, I'm out. I got Matt DeAndrea and I'm kind of out. And I go, Jay Leno? And he goes, yeah, that him. So I go, yeah, and I go.
You and Lana have a show called Car Friends.
Yeah, you could put it on the speed
driving
speed dial network.
Network. So I go, yeah, I did do a stand up special with Jay Leno, and he goes, oh, okay, what's that? What's that like? How's that go? And I go, well, you know, I go out, I do about 15, 20 minutes of stand-up, then, you know, Jay comes on, and Jay does some stand-up, we do like an interview, and we play like a game, and then we pull out the balls from the hopper with the name, and we improvise, and my dad goes, I could see that.
No, that might work.
I thought, well, also, you could see it.
You could literally see it.
You can see it. It's all in the phraseology, but you could see it.
I could see that. That could maybe work.
That's good.
Good luck with that.
But my mom has the give me one reason for cable. Yeah. My dad has I could see. He's trying to, it's like we're on an island and I have a piece of charcoal and I'm trying to draw him something. Or you could just watch it.
Yeah.
You could physically.
It's there.
It's just there.
Yeah.
You don't
have to leave the house.
You could watch it.
Yeah.
Now, he's not going to watch it. But the point is I could see that. That's got Jay Leno in it.
Yeah.
Where's that rank compared to give me one reason?
I have thoughts. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to something sort of that maybe you're not basing this on. But for me, it's all about how many other people are experiencing my humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
And like dad being like kind of out of it, like it sucks. And I'm sure relatively hurtful. But if your mom announces to a table full of people that she can't
loved
think of
ones.
Yes, that know you, that she can't think of one reason to get cable, that's more shaming. That's more humiliating to me.
For me.
Yes.
But
by proxy.
You have to consider the audience. Those aren't your loved ones.
That's true.
And those aren't Brian's loved
nobody,
ones.
Wait, nobody bristled.
Nobody thought of an answer. And I've been so poisoned over the years because I remember very clearly, this is sort of with my wiring, started offering up gardening shows. They have cooking shows. And the rest of the table kind of joined in. And there was not a peep of the Man Show or Loveline or anything like that. It was only after leaving the dinner and driving to Loveline that it dawned on me that so there wasn't the discomfort level that I wish was prevalent at that table, but it was non-existent.
Okay, so I'm back to zero.
We have to remove that.
The Jim Carolla incident recently is strong. There's something poetic about give me one reason when, in fact, you have two shows that simultaneously doing well. These aren't like, shows that are floundering. These are shows that are probably like signature shows
thriving on
the network. Popular network.
Yeah.
Big network.
And if Rich Banks wants a challenge, he might have to incorporate Tracy Chapman on this one. Give me one reason.
All right. So we still...
Mom's still the leader.
The bottom of the leaderboard is still mom.
She inches him out, even though the other one's pretty bad.
In a different family-related note, I walked down to the theater in my home on Friday night to see what Sonny was up to. He's fond of just watching movies. Sometimes with friends, sometimes alone, but he really loves the movie.
Howard Hughes-esque.
Mm-hmm.
Very much. I walked
Kleenex
in there, knocked
the
over a jar of urine. I walked in there. He was watching, and you got to look it up for me, Chris, because I don't remember all the official particulars, but he was watching. Now, I've gotten over the part where he's a 15-year-old boy. When I was his age, I would have just been watching Armageddon over and over again or Con Air or something.
The great.
He turns his nose up at all of that. But he's watching, I think from 1951, Sunset Boulevard.
Oh!
There you go.
Sunset Boulevard.
Interesting. A great movie, great musical. Yeah.
1950.
Things they look as if we've never said goodbye.
I didn't even know there was singing in it.
That's a Broadway musical, too.
Oh, there's no singing in this.
I know.
Sorry, I didn't know if you knew that. I was mansplaining
Sunset
Boulevard.
I've seen this many times.
Norma Desmond.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I'd never seen it, and it's got William Holden in it, I think, and Gloria Swanson and all that. And it's a very creepy movie. Very slow pace, very
slow burn.
Very 50s, very slow. I may have been black and white. I can't recall.
Oh, very much so.
It's got the classic lines, I'm ready for that close-up.
What's up, Mr. DeMille?
Right. And it's got all those, but most people know those but don't know the movie. He was just watched it right on through.
Wow.
I was like, I watched for about 10 minutes. I was like, all right, well, you're on your own, but you'll be back upstairs in a matter of 20 minutes. You're going to burn out. And I came back down hour and 20 minutes later. He was just there. Watching it.
Good for him.
I was like, why are you watching? I heard it was one of the classics. I want to watch all the classics
over here.
Yeah. And it's also, I was, It's a blessing to have an attention span.
Yeah.
It's fast fading and yes. Most of the populace, sure. They just there's nothing exploding. There's no car chases. Like I'm out. But it's such a gift to have that ability
yes.
to just sit. When I was talking to Mitch Album about Tuesdays with Maury, he's like, I just sat and listened.
Yeah.
That's all I did. I visited Maury. He had ALS, and I just sat and listened the whole time.
This movie starts with a dead body, and there's 90 minutes until something else happens again.
That's exactly right.
That's some concentration right
God,
there.
I can't wait to get his thoughts on whatever happened to Baby Jane.
Oh, he's going to – oh, he maybe seen it already, but he's watching it all.
I was similar to Sonny in that around the age of 15 or 16, 17, whatever it was, that's when I really fell in love with movies. And I was like, I need to see these classics, these ones that everyone knows and everyone references. Mm-hmm. I need to see the classics. I didn't see Sunset Boulevard, but I saw Apocalypse Now and on and on, you know, on and on and on, movies that came out before my time. There is a danger to seeing them at a young age. You don't appreciate them like an adult appreciates them. And I have seen almost everyone since and re-appreciated, if that makes sense. I imagine if Sonny's, you know, love affair with movies is lifelong, he'll revisit Sunset Boulevard at some point and get a lot more out of it.
Yeah, the interesting part of it is when I showed up for about the last 10 minutes of it, he was all in. He liked it. He was catching me up. He reviewed it in his own head. Nice. So there you go with that. We got Gina's cranberry sauce brought in.
Yeah. Now I know where we all stand with, was cranberry sauce broken? No, it wasn't. But I just want to know what your thoughts are on this cranberry sauce.
Made with no water.
No, with half a cup of water, half a cup of orange juice. Orange zest, and a secret ingredient, which I think you'll appreciate, a pinch of salt.
Yeah, it's good.
You like it?
It's good.
Thank you.
It's really good.
But in the effort of being honest, this is good. I like this. I would eat this Thanksgiving. Prefer if that's the orange juice.
Okay.
Well, just the people don't think
I'll remember that for next Thanksgiving.
Every time. Like, everything you make is amazing. It is very good.
Thank you.
I like this.
It's a little
citrusy.
Got a little zest.
A little zing.
It's nice.
Yeah. Thank you.
Cranberry not broken, but this isn't broken either.
Yeah.
I like it. All right.
Well, there is a lot of it, and I don't really eat cranberry sauce.
We got Tales from the Cheap. I think, do we have an opening for that? Yeah, I think we'll do a holiday version. I don't know if you guys have holiday versions of Tales from the Cheap.
20-year-old Tupperware, homemade clothes, powdered eggs. It's time for Tales from the Cheap.
My early memories of Thanksgiving is going to my grandma's house and sitting at the kids' table, which has become a trope now, but they had
the
them,
card
man.
Table.
It just popped in my head. As a kid, everyone wants the leg. They want the turkey leg.
Oh, sure.
That's what you want. You want to like hold
gnaw
it.
Gnaw it like a man.
You want to gnaw on it.
French king.
There's only two turkey legs. There's seven kids. Somebody needs to figure that one out. Do you cook X amount? Like, do you do a turkey leg for every kid? It's a little bit of a battle over who's getting that turkey leg.
Didn't Madden figure that out? Didn't he have like eight legs on the turkey?
Yeah,
like
let Monsanto
turkey.
Figure it out.
Yeah, he had a turducken with like eight legs on it. All right, let's talk to Joe, who's 43 from Seattle. Joe?
Hi, Adam Bald. Hey, Gina. Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you.
By the way. Oh, speaking of which, I read something the other day, and I thought of you, Gina. Did you know that Oscar the Grouch has a cousin called Ashkenazi, as in Ashkenazi,
that's funny.
The Israeli version of Sesame Street?
That's very funny.
That's
pretty funny, yeah.
No, it is. Well, whether this is officially canon or not is debated because they filmed the segment with Ashkenazi, but then in the test screenings, the kids did not get the joke, and the parents thought it was kind of offensive, so they never actually aired it. But
that's
there is
unfortunate.
Footage of Ashkenazi in the archives.
That's
somewhere.
Fucking great.
Wow, I need the bootleg version of this.
Chagorim Sameach, everybody. That was worth it. Thank you.
What do you got, Joe?
My pleasure. So one Christmas, I was out shopping for Christmas cards, and I found this package that looked like very ornate decoration on the outside and a very sweet holiday theme. I thought it looked beautiful. I got a packet of them for friends and family. I took it home. It turned out I had actually bought a bunch of cards that were for gifting money to people. There was a very prominent slot in each one that's like, here's a gift. I hope you enjoy the holidays. And I was too cheap to actually put money or a gift in each one for all the people I wanted to send these cards to. So I went back to the store and I tried to exchange them. The store manager's like, no, you've opened the package. We can't exchange it, and it's a seasonal thing. So I just took them back home and I sent them to everybody with a note inside that said, sorry, there's no gift in here. I mean, there was something printed on it that made it like extra humiliating, something along the lines of, oh, this gift shows how much I care about you or whatever. I tried to Sharpie over it so they couldn't read it.
That's worse.
You know, if you Sharpie over ink printed on cardboard, you can still read what's under
it.
So
it highlights it in a way.
I used to get from Aunt Pat the card that held the coins.
Yep.
You know, and there was a coin in it for every year you were on the planet, which would be effective now. When I was seven, it didn't really move the needle. Now that I'm in my 50s, hey, you know, yeah, that's something. But I don't think there are ever quarters in them. I wonder if she bought the cards and went, I don't want the ones that take the quarters. I need the fine slot ones. I'm a nickel and dimer over here.
It'll fall right through otherwise.
Yeah. I think there would be dimes in there.
Wow.
And you'd get it was thoughtful, didn't change my bracket too much, but any port in a storm, I recall.
It would be easier just to send you the dollar when you were 10.
Yeah, but that would have been 30 cents too much. Pat, Ed, it was, again, that Pat and Vince Bruno shared one car well into, I mean, their whole adult life. It was always one diesel rabbit, the slowest car. Boy. It was a Chevy Nova before then, got into a diesel rabbit at some point.
Are you secretly jealous?
Of the sharing of the car?
Not the car specifically, but I think about it all the time. Where it's like, if we had one car, it's an extra whatever, $100, a few hundred dollars a month.
It's also the perfect out for anything you don't want to attend or go to. It's just like, Pat's got the car. She took it to work. Mm-hmm. She's not coming back till 5.
I
got nothing I could do.
Love to.
Love to grab you at the airport, but cannot. No,
just
can
got the
do.
One car, you know.
Yeah. Joe.
Yeah, these cards are definitely made for holding folding paper money, so it would have been a big investment to put something in for everybody. So it's like, nope.
What's the temperature like over there in Seattle? I got a guy I work with at the other shop. He says he's going to Seattle for his wedding his anniversary. He's lamenting that he's worried about the homeless people over there and some of the horror stories you hear. How's Seattle looking these days?
Well, I mean, it was really chaotic last summer. I mean, everybody in the country heard about the Chaz occupied protest area. But, I mean, I think that the national media made more out of it than it really was. There's really just one designated area where everybody sort of played by the rules. If you wanted to protest, you go to like this one stretch of block where the protests against the police are happening. But if you're like 15 feet out of that area, you're just a civilian people and you just walk by and nobody cares. So I think that incidents get national coverage out of proportion to how much they actually affect people in the city. The amount of homelessness in the city, that is something that actually does affect daily life, and people see that and they're sad. But I mean, it's such a complicated thing, and I think people are legitimately frustrated. They don't know what to do about it. I listened pretty closely when you have Drew on talking about his experiences with what he thinks works to solve the homeless problem, but lots of things and very, very varied reasons that people end up in that situation. So it's frustrating because there's no magic bullet.
Yeah. See, sometimes it's drugs. Other times it's drugs. Sometimes it's drugs. Other times it's drugs.
It's a combination of drugs and alcohol.
We can sit here listing every possible reason.
Yes. I will. I'm sure there is such a thing of the mother three who the plant closed down and the old man moved to Florida. Now she's forced out onto the street. But I don't see any of those people, and I don't see anyone with their kids ever, which is good, I guess, and they all seem fairly addled, either mentally or chemically or both, I would say, but it didn't seem like it makes sense to pick the outlier and decide that's the face of homelessness. But it wouldn't work if you were trying to solve any problem that way.
Right.
Pick a kind of outlier, then kind of romanticize that outlier, and then direct your attention toward that outlier. Although I just had Chris grab a clip of our mayor, Garcetti. When's that fucking guy going to India, by the way? I'll drive. I will, unlike Vince Bruno or Pat, I will drive him to the airport.
You're the one car.
But he's got a plan for homelessness at this. Hey, Joe, thanks, by the way, for that offering.
Yeah, no. Glad to bring everyone down. But
no, it was me. It was me. I brought up the homelessness. He's did a press briefing, I don't know, a week ago, and he was talking about what we can do about homelessness. Here's his idea.
It's always true that we've needed an all-hands-on approach during this crisis. It's more true now than ever. It's critical that we keep making the most of this moment.
So all right, hold on a second. What moment are we talking about? You've been in office for a long time.
He's the new mayor?
The thing about the homelessness is it's not like it's a tsunami where it just washes up.
Right.
Like, you know, 10 minutes ago, there was nothing. And now it grows every year slowly. It's like saying, oh, no one could have ever foreseen this ivy growing up the side of the house. Now it's all our problems. It's like, no, you could have fucking clipped it early.
It's not growing every day.
But no, we all got to get involved here to solve this problem. We'll do it together. All right. Here we go.
The average Angelino who might be listening today. Well, here's a few things you can do to help. If you're a landlord, we need you. And trust me, you'll get your rent every month on time, if you join with us. Open up your available units to formerly unhoused folks. We have city-funded rapid rehousing vouchers and 3,300 emergency housing vouchers that I lobbied in Washington to bring to places like Hollywood.
It's a Freudian
slip. Thanks to the Biden administration and Congress, we'll be moving forward. These can subsidize your rent till 2030. You can provide a home to a tenant in real need of stable housing.
I don't think getting the guy strung out on fentanyl. You call it previously housed or currently unhoused. Stop giving it euphemistic fucking titles. Formerly, we've all been unhoused at one point or another. You crash on a futon. You call your folks. You move back into your old bedroom for a couple of months until you right the ship or you get another roommate or whatever it is. Nobody is going to open. And by the way, what about the other people in the seven-unit building that has the fentanyl guy with the fucking lamp cord for a leash and his dog moving in underneath you and your daughter's unit up there?
Not an attractive tenant.
Also, we're going to pay for this till 2030? Let's
it's going to go on for a while.
All right. Anyway. Mitch, Alma is going to join us momentarily, right? He's on the thing.
Yes.
All right. So let me hit Hyundai. Yeah. Widest range of electrified vehicles on the market. Yeah. They're really making strides in this department. Remote charging, flexible ways you can fuel up. In the 2022 Tucson and Santa Fe plug-in hybrid EVs, you can use electric when you want and use gas when you need it. Don't choose between a style or function and power or range. Nope, get it all. Do it all with the plug-in hybrid EV. Plus, turbocharged engines mean quiet, rapid acceleration. People don't know about turbos as it quiets the engine as well as gives it much more power. Digital key allows you to use your Android phone as a spare key. And you can learn more at HyundaiUSA.com. That is HyundaiUSA.com. Mitch Alm, a very prolific writer and an entrepreneur, philanthropic entrepreneur and musician. Very interesting story. We'll talk to him right after this. Hey, Geico, do you own? Do you rent? Well, you do one or the other, right? You know, it's hard work out there. Owning, renting. You want to save some money? How about you bundle?
Bundle your policies at Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle the homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you got so much to do already. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save at Geico. That is geico.com today. That's geico.com.
It's time for Nicaraguan Name That Movie with Adam's buddy Oswaldo. See if you can guess which movie this famous line is from.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
If you said Sunset Boulevard.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
You're correct. Now, back to the show.
My God, that's producing. Mitch Elm is our guest. The book is The Stranger in the Lifeboats, available now on Amazon or wherever you find finer books. Good to talk to you again, Mitch.
Thanks, Adam. Good to talk to you, too.
I was fascinated by hearing your story when we spoke earlier for my Take a Knee podcast. So at the risk of being a little repetitive, I think maybe we should go over some of that stuff. We can start with the Tuesdays with Maury, and I was very interested in how that book came about. So if you don't mind, tell us how that one came about.
Well, I was at the time about 37 years old. I was a pretty ambitious 90-hour-a-week sports writer, a sportscaster, and that was my whole life. And happened to be flicking the channels one night and caught the Nightline program and did a double take because there on the screen talking to Ted Koppel was my old college professor, Maury Schwartz, and he was talking to him about what it was like to die from Lou Gehrig's disease. And I had been really close with Maury in college. I had taken every class he offered. I majored in sociology. I took my honors thesis with him, everything, and then lost touch with him for 16 years while I was chasing my own tail in my career. And then I found out that he was dying. So I called him up. It was supposed to be a one-time phone call. At the end of the call, he said, well, would you come visit me? I went to come visit him. It was supposed to be a one-time visit. But I was so taken with how satisfied he was with his life and how content he was, even as he was dying from this terrible disease. And he was twice my age and 10 times happier with his life than I was. And I began to go back the next Tuesday, and all the Tuesdays that he had left in his life to sort of get that answer to that question. You know, what do we realize when we really know we're going to die that puts the rest of our life into perspective? And wouldn't it be great to have that perspective when you're young enough and actually healthy enough to do something about it? And eventually that became the book Tuesdays with Maury, quite by accident. I didn't go there to write a book. I went there because I clearly needed a change in my life, but turned into this little book that I wrote to pay his medical bills. And then it kind of changed my life.
Did you ever, if I can ask you, Did you ever consider the paradox of, we should all expect that we're going to die, whether or not we have ALS or some advanced disease? You'd be naive. Obviously, that's, you know, built into youth. But did you ever explore that or any thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. Well, Maury said that to me all the time. He said, everybody knows they're going to die, but nobody actually believes it. Mm-hmm. You know, we think they're going to invent something, mm-hmm. you know, the day before we're supposed to go. Oh, we just invented the pill that's going to save everybody. And when you really have to confront your mortality, then you realize you should have been living your life every day as if there was like a little bird on your shoulder that you had to check in with and say, is today the day I'm going to die? And you know, obviously every day of your life, except one, the bird's going to say no. But that one that the bird says yes, are you prepared and ready? Or is your response going to be, oh, no, wait. I got a million things I now have to do now that I know I'm actually going to die. And, you know, I didn't get to do this and I didn't get to do that. And I didn't spend time with my family and I didn't spend time with my loved ones. And so, I mean, I think about that all the time. I think that's one of the biggest lessons I learned from that experience.
The story about why you decided to turn it into a book and sell the book is an interesting one. Some words that Maury gave you. I'm interested in hearing that again.
Well, he told me that he thought he was going to die a second death. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I'm going to die when I die. And then wherever I am, I'm going to die again because my family is going to have to sell the house to pay the medical bills. Mm. And, you know, that would kill me all over again. And that was when I found out how deeply in debt he was for years of dealing with ALS. And I went around to publishers in New York trying to get the idea for a book to be sold because that was the only way I knew how to make any money. And I said, you know, this is a great thing that's going on, a great lesson that we're having. And, you know, I just need enough money to pay his medical bills. Just that's all I need. And pretty much everybody said, no, no, thank you. You're bored. It's boring. You're a sports writer. It's depressing. Nobody's going to want to read it. Mm. And I would have given up probably if it was just for me. But because it was for him, I kind of pushed and kept pushing and finally found somebody 3 weeks before he died. Wow. And I was able to tell him, Maury, we're going to turn these visits into a little book. And the best part is they're going to give us some money up front and I'm going to give it all to you and just go pay your medical bills. You don't have to die a second time. And I always say for me, that was the end of Tuesdays with Maury because, you know, I'd finally learned to do one nice thing for this older man who had done so many nice things for me in his life. And I finally did something, you know, that wasn't about my career and wasn't about ambition, or which I, all I had been about up till that point. And then he died and I wrote the book after he died. He never read a word of it, which is funny because people are now studying it in China and Switzerland and Australia and all that. And, you know, his reach has gone so far for someone who's not even here to teach it. But it wasn't supposed to be a big book. I can tell you that it was a tiny little 20,000 copy print run that they thought I would have in my basement for the rest of my life in big boxes or give out to people who came for Christmas, you know, but, it turned into something else.
Turned into about 20 million units sold.
Yeah, something like that.
Gina?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, in Judaism, you know, I'm sure a lot of people have heard this word called tzedakah. And it's, you know, basically how you give to other people. And the highest, one of the highest forms of tzedakah is doing something for someone that you can never be repaid. And so it really struck me because that's really what you did, is the highest form of tzedakah. And when you said that, you know, he was afraid to die a second time, I thought you were going to say something different. And of course, his is more logistical and it makes perfect sense. But I've also heard a parable that your second death is when the last person stops talking about you. And you also made that come true for him because the world will be talking about him forever. And it's very, very cool.
Yeah, I know the parable. It's a poem about people who are buried in the ground and they're lamenting that they're going to die a second time when nobody remembers them anymore. And that the second death is when you're forgotten.
Right.
And you're right. Yeah. You know, he's not likely to be forgotten anytime soon. And nothing could make me happier because he was a really terrific and wise guy.
It's the plot of Coco.
Yeah.
It is. And it's also a nice parable, or I don't even know if it's a parable, but it's nice, which is, It started completely organically. You know, you wanted to go pay homage to this person that touched your life. And then it organically became a book when that person wasn't going to be able to pay for their medical bills. And it was all done in a sort of organic, philanthropic, whatever. I mean, it sounds kind of trite, but the best things always kind of come out of that versus the, I got a new idea. Mm-hmm. It's not Bitcoin, but it's, but it's like Bitcoin. You know what I mean? And it's like, and maybe those things cosmically don't work out that well because you shouldn't be repaid for that. This is, you were cosmically repaid quite a bit for this effort.
Yeah, I have tended to find in my career that, you know, if you try to do things for the right reason, don't try to aim them. It usually works out. And if it doesn't work out, you still feel good about it because, you know, if it doesn't work out commercially, you still feel good about it because you did the right, you know, did it for the right reasons. And pretty much all my books ever since then have contained some kind of element of From Tuesdays with Maury, some lesson I learned or something that I've been thinking about or people have been talking to me about, all the way up to The Stranger in the Lifeboat, which is at its core is about help. It's about asking for help and what we expect when we ask for help and how sometimes we don't recognize it even when it shows up on our doorstep.
I know I've spoke to you about the work you're doing in Haiti and that the tragedy with the young girl you adopted from Haiti and the orphanage that you're running over there. But can we talk about that for a minute?
Sure. So I took over an orphanage in Haiti in 2010, right after the earthquake. I've been there for 12 years. I'm there every month. We have 53 children that we raise at any given time. All of our kids have college scholarships waiting for them, and a number of them are up here now in America going to college. And when they're done, they come back and they work at the orphanage for 2 years in whatever field they studied. And then they go into the Haitian society to make Haiti a better country. It's not a pipeline to America. There are enough people who are coming that direction. We want to try to put ourselves out of business in Haiti eventually. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon, because we have children who have been left to die in the woods because their parents didn't want them. We have children who have been left in malnutrition centers or medical centers and just dropped off, and nobody ever came back for them. And we don't even have birth certificates. We don't have names. We have to invent birthdays and identities. But when they come to us, I mean, they're treated with love and joy, and they go to school 4 hours a day in English and 4 hours a day in French. And they're the most incredible, thankful, polite, devoid of any kind of internet poisoning or iPhone poisoning, or we don't have television, we don't have anything like that. So you get to see childhood in its natural form. And the time of every month that I spend down there is always the highlight for me. And as far as Chica is concerned, we adopted one of the girls from our orphanage who came to us when she was three. She survived the earthquake, believe it or not, when she was 3 days old, and her little home collapsed around her, but she lived through it. And you would have thought that would have been enough for one lifetime. But when she was five, she developed a brain tumor, and we brought her to America, and she never went home. We basically became our daughter, and we traveled around the world for a couple years trying to find a cure. And although she was supposed to die in 4 months, she lived for 2 years, and those were the two of the most amazing years we ever had. Unfortunately, she died when she was seven, and I was pretty angry at the world and God and anything else, when she died, because I just couldn't understand how there could be a benevolent God that couldn't be benevolent to a seven-year-old. And it took me a few years to try to recover from that. And The Stranger in the Lifeboat is actually, while it's a novel, it's sort of my healing book about, you know, like I say, when you call out for help and, it doesn't come exactly the way you want it, does that mean you're being ignored? And I created a story that kind of addresses that, which I'm happy to share with you if you want. But that's what sort of Chica's life kind of ended up reflected in this latest book.
I would like you to share that. But I would also like to ask, how much of a reset is it for you when you go to Haiti? I mean, the theme for you seems to be doing things for others, but getting a lot out of it for yourself.
Well, the reset that you talk about starts when you get off the plane and you have to make sure that you're in an armored car when you go from the airport to your orphanage, because there are gangs that are out there that are ready to kidnap anybody at any time. And you've probably heard about the missionaries that were kidnapped, but there have been over 800 people kidnapped in Haiti, most of them Haitians, just this year alone. So just having to subtly think about, okay, can we take that turn there? Does the bodyguard have his gun? You know, all those types of things. You're resetting, definitely, from, the American experience. And then when we get into the orphanage, nothing works, you know, like the internet barely functions and you lose all contact with the outside world. The kids come running up to you and jumping all over you, and you're just lost in this sea of children who are just so happy to have you there, and they want to play and they want to show you this, and everything is with crayons and pencils. You know, there's nobody showing you an iPhone or look at this video. You know, everybody's they're jumping up in the tree and pulling these canip fruits out of the tree and opening them up and eating the nuts that are inside. So it's a total reset of your priorities. And it's lights out at, you know, when we lose electricity, which is every night, because you only get electrical power 12 hours a day. And so everything is reset. And I like it. You know, I sleep better there than I ever sleep here in the States, even though there it's a 4-inch mattress, you know, with a little old pillow. And I never set an alarm clock because the kids wake me up every morning outside the door. Are you up, Mr. Mitch? Well, I am now, you know, and it's usually about 6 o'clock in the morning. So, Yeah, it's a wonderful experience. I mean, I know it sounds like I'm doing something, you know, because you say you run an orphanage. But to be honest, I get way more out of it than I feel like I'm giving.
What is going on with Haiti, and what is the potential future, and why is this going on this way in Haiti?
The assassination, the coup.
Yeah, just what is that?
Well, I mean, it's a long, long story, and I'm sure you don't want to hear the whole thing, but Haiti has a long history of corruption in politics. That's nothing new. The poverty is so strong there. It's the second poorest country in the world and the poorest on this side of the world. And so you have, you know, when you have to pay to go to school and nobody has any money, you're not going to get an educated populace. When you have a corrupt political system that wants to keep everybody kind of ignorant and poor and just keep the money at the very, very, very top, you're not going to have a society that advances. And then it's the gangs move in when the police are neutered, which they are there. And if you want to see what a society without police looks like, come to Port-au-Prince, because the police have very little power. They're demoralized. They don't have weapons. The gangs have all the control and the money. And so therefore they control the streets and they make them very dangerous. And so, but somehow through that, the Haitian people are incredibly resilient, incredibly. And, you know, they've been paying a price for over 200 years for being the first and only successful slave revolt country in the history of the world. And they threw out the French and they said, no, you're not going to enslave us. We're going to take over our own country. And that was 1804. And as soon as they did that, nobody applauded them. Everybody stopped dealing with them because all the other countries in the world were still dealing with slavery of their own. And they didn't want to recognize a country that, you know, suddenly the slaves were in charge. And so they've been paying a price for it ever since. And I just wish there could be some intervention by the UN or the US or something to try to make the country a little safer for the people who have to worry every time they go outside.
Yeah, I always say this, but it's 2021. You know, I just can't believe that this stuff is going on. It still goes on. You hear all the horror stories. They sound like the same horror stories from a couple hundred years ago.
And that's in between natural disasters.
Yeah, or like 2,000 years ago. Yeah. And then I'm always like, but to what end? Like, this doesn't seem like it's going to evolve its way out of this. At some point, can we get some delegation together, some boots on the ground, some international group, UN, what have you? Like, is there any talk of that? I mean, you certainly would know more than we would.
You know, the people talk of it, but the government doesn't. Government still hasn't figured out who killed the president. Can you imagine if we were in America and it's now December and our president was killed in August and we still didn't know who did it?
Well, Kamala Harris, come on. I mean, I think we all know that. Yeah. But so they're just, it's just, I don't
point to JFK.
I don't think people know. Well, that's a conspiracy, but at least we put someone, or we tried to put someone behind bars. True. But I don't think people really know, we haven't talked about it in a while, what corruption does. You know what I mean? We always talk about kind of like poverty. We talk about education. We talk about environment and stuff like that. Corruption, when you have a really corrupt government, country, entity, it just can't flourish. It can't move.
And no matter how much a world power comes and tries to help, you know, like we talk about, you know, they bring sacks of grain and flour. Well, those don't get to the people that need it.
By
so yeah, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Does anyone?
Yes. Yes. And yes.
Does anyone ever bother the orphanage?
Thank God, to this point, we have not been bothered. No.
So the way, I mean, the answer to the question of, you know, how do you fix Haiti?
Oh, good, you have an answer.
Well, it's a slow boat answer, but it's what Mitch is talking about, which is get one kid educated and then bring them back and let them populate.
Yeah.
At a certain point, there's going to be more of them than there are gangbangers, and that's how you fix Haiti. I imagine, sort of slowly and organically, that seems to be what the plan is, right, Mitch?
Yeah, I've always felt that, you know, I can't fix what's the matter with Haiti, and nobody who comes down there can fix what's the matter with Haiti. But if you can take a little tiny corner and try to turn a few kids' lives around and try to inspire them to do something, and someone else comes and takes another tiny corner, and someone else takes another tiny corner, then eventually maybe you can turn it around. My hope one day is that one of our kids becomes the president of the country. And when they say, well, who did you know? Or, you know, what silver spoon were you born with that you could, you know, take over? And then they say, I grew up in an orphanage. And then we'll have come full circle. That's my hope. We'll see.
The story of the stranger in the lifeboat that I'm now circling back to. Can we talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah. So the plot, here's the 30-second movie trailer of it. There's this really rich guy who owns this big yacht, and he invites all his rich, fancy friends, celebrities, business movers and shakers for this week-long soiree. And the night before they're due to come back, the thing mysteriously explodes, blows up. Everybody is killed except 10 people, 5 of whom are the rich guests and 5 of whom are the help and the staff. And they make their way to this life raft, and they're out on this life raft for 3 days. And nobody's coming for them. There's sharks spotted in the water. They're running out of food. They're crying out desperate, you know, and alone. And suddenly they see this guy floating in the water, and they pull him into the boat. And he's a young guy, nondescript, very average looking, nothing special. And they're peppering him with questions, and he doesn't say anything. And finally, one of the passengers says, well, thank the Lord we found you. And he says, I am the Lord. And that's where it jumps off into what happens as the days transpire. And, you know, I mentioned to you that the theme of it is when we call out for help, when we ask for help. Well, you know, they were all crying out for help. And along comes this guy who looks like he rents surfboards for a living. And they do not believe that he could possibly be who he says he is. And, you know, they say to him, oh, you're the Lord. Yeah, sure. Okay, what are you doing here? And he says, well, haven't you been calling me? And they say, okay, fine. So what, you're going to save us? And he says, I can only save you if everybody in the boat believes I am who I say I am at the same time. And of course, with 10 disparate people, some of whom are very wealthy, some of whom aren't or whatever, you're never going to get that. And they, despite the fact that, you know, they've been asking for help, they keep denying that this guy could possibly be the help that they want. And as the days go on and things get more dire and there's storms and shark attacks and all this thing, some of them start to change their mind, some of them don't. And it's kind of a parable about, you know, when are we ready to accept help? You know, even if it's not under our terms.
How does it end?
No.
I can't tell you how it ends, but I can tell you a few things along the way. A, that the guy is not necessarily God. So just because he says he is, I'm not saying one way or the other. You got to read the book. But it did give me an opportunity to ask the questions. Like if I were to disappear from this podcast suddenly and a voice were to replace me and said, well, Mitch is gone, but this is God, and I'm going to give you 60 seconds on your podcast. Go ahead, ask me anything you want. I'm sure you'd have some pretty good questions. And I tried to take those questions and put them in the mouths of the passengers who were on this boat. So, for example, at one point, one of them says, well, you're God, you know, you say you're God. Do you actually hear any prayers? Do you actually answer any prayers? And he says, I answer every prayer, but sometimes the answer is no. You know, something that I have found to be true in my life. Or, of course, the ultimate question, which is what we would all ask. And I sort of surreptitiously asked through a character, you know, why do people have to die? And in this case, one of the men in the boat lost his wife and he's crying. And he says to this God character, you know, why did you take my wife? Why did my wife have to die? And the answer is, well, when people die here on earth, people are always saying, why did God have to take them? Maybe a better question would be, what did we do to deserve God giving them to us? You know, what did we do to warrant their sweetness or their memories or all the good times we had with them? Didn't you have that with your wife? And he says, yeah, every day. And the God character says, well, those memories are a gift, but their absence isn't a punishment. I'm not trying to make your life miserable. And he concludes by saying, I know that you cry when your loved ones die here on earth and they pass away, but I can assure you those who are leaving the earth are not crying. And, you know, I wrote that as much for myself as I did for anybody who reads the book, because as I mentioned to you before, I had to come to some kind of terms with the loss of a 7-year-old child. And I could not be angry like I was when it first happened for the rest of my life. And being able to kind of look at it and say, well, wait a minute. You know, she came into our lives when we were in our mid-50s. My wife and I had prayed to have children 15, 20 years ago, and we never did. And now all of a sudden, we had a child, and we had a 5-year-old with all the beauty and joy and funniness and all that that comes with having a 5-year-old and a 6-year-old and a 7-year-old. What do we do to deserve that? You know, why? And instead of looking at it as what was taken from us, you know, I tried to look at it as what was given to us. And I find that that was a lot more comforting way to go through a loss.
Oh, it's God on the phone.
Could be God on the hotline.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Mitch, you're known as a sports guy. Let's shift gears. Rams on a 3-game slide. Is Stafford really the answer, or is he past his prime? Go.
Okay. Yeah.
Fucking 3 games in a row, those assholes have lost. Yeah, well, Mitch was telling me the reason. Well, he wasn't telling me, but I was at. You know, he's such a great sports writer, and it's he was saying it's because he wasn't really that interested in sports, which is I think is a great answer, and I want to explore that a little bit. But I also feel that way about. I make some car documentaries, and they're better than the ones that are made by the car guys because we don't make them like we're interested in cars. We're more interested in the story of it.
Right.
And so you get a better product, even though it's about cars. And if you want to see a really shitty car doc, then watch one made by car guys because they're not that good. And do you bring some of that? I mean, we were talking about it, bringing that mentality to sports writing.
Yeah, actually, I think I bring it to all of my writing. I mean, I'm not a theologian, but I wrote about a book about, you know, a guy who claims to be God in a lifeboat. I think if I were writing it from a theological point of view or a particular religion or dogma point of view, it would not be as accessible, you know, and it's the same thing with sports. I think if I told you, Adam, I was never the guy who memorized who led the league in triples in 1943. First of all, they have books. You can look that up. But secondly, who can remember that? You know, I was always interested in more of the losers and the people who came in second or, you know, worked their whole way in the Olympics and finished fourth and just didn't get a medal. You know, I think people can relate to that part of sports better than they can LeBron James, you know, who's like Superman. And none of us really have that kind of skill, or few of us. So, you know, I just never wrote it. I always thought that if I'm going to write sports, I always had like a disinterested grandmother in North Carolina in my mind. And here I was, a sports columnist in Detroit. And I always said, if I can make that woman want to read this column, then I did something right. And that was sort of my acid test, and not assume, because the sports nuts, they're going to read it anyhow. They might hate you or whatever, or say it's so, but they're going to read it because they read everything. But if you really want to try to pull people in, find the humanity in any story, sports story or otherwise.
Yeah, it's a very good approach. Once again, the book is called The Stranger in the Lifeboat, and it's available on Amazon, wherever you find books, and you can also
finer books,
and also you can check out Mitch Album's website. And I'm guessing if people want to donate or be involved with one of your many charities, it might be on that website.
It would be, and the orphanage is havefaithhaiti.org if people are interested in that. But yeah, they can't remember that. If you go to mitchalbum.com, all the information is there under the charities, and that's very kind of you to offer that. But that says, I'm not soliciting anything from anybody. I don't believe in that. And, you know, people find a way to what they want to do and help. And if you do the right thing, I've found that people usually find you on their own. And I hope that people do.
Well, normally when I say you're doing the Lord's work, I don't mean it literally, but in this case, we're getting pretty close to doing the Lord's work. Mitch Album, thanks so much for joining us. And I hope to speak to you again soon.
Been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on. Anytime.
Thanks, Mitch. Oh, one of the good ones, everybody. All right.
I can't wait to read that book.
Yeah, he's
I know the ending.
It's a great
writer. You don't know anything.
Well, I know about stamps.com. Ah, looking to skip the post office and dodge the hectic holiday shopping traffic? Save time, save money with stamps.com. Stamps.com lets you compare rates and print labels and access exclusive discounts on UPS and USPS services all year long, up to 40% off of USPS rates and 76% off UPS. So whether you're selling online, running an office, you got a little side hustle going, it just makes sense, especially if your business sends more mail and packages out during the holidays. We've always used stamps.com over here, all the merch and books and everything we send out. It's been, God, well over a decade. Stamps.com saves you time, saves you money, saves you stress during the holidays. Right, Dawson?
Save time and money this holiday season with Stamps.com. Sign up with promo code Adam for a special offer that includes a four-week trial, free postage, and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code Adam.
Well, we didn't really scratch the surface of our trending topics yesterday with Chris Maxipatis, so... thought we'd bring him in and finish up some of those subjects. We'll do that right after this.